It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up later in the program, the same-sex marriage question is back in federal courts today for the first time since the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act last June.
Our next guest has been nicknamed the real-life Lorax by National Geographic and the Einstein of the Treetops by the Wall Street Journal. Meg Laumann is a biologist who spends her time exploring the canopies of the world's forests.
She says there's a lot we can learn about life on the ground from being up in the trees. And it could be, she says, the key to figuring out how to protect and conserve the world's forests for many years to come. She'll be speaking to that point and more tomorrow at Beloit College.
In addition to being a biologist, Meg Laumann is a writer and educator, and she's currently the chief of science and sustainability at the California Academy of Sciences. Meg, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
Well, you have, I think, about the coolest job that I've come across in a while. You explore canopies of forests. Can you talk about that a bit? What is a canopy in a forest? What are you looking at?
Sure. I guess I probably am one of the very few paid arbornauts, or people that climb trees technically, which is similar to an astronaut who explores outer space. I get to explore the treetops. And believe it or not, that is the center of so much of life on Earth. We estimate that half of what lives on land actually lives in the tops of trees, and some of it actually never comes to the forest floor. So it's a pretty extraordinary place.
Now, how can canopy exploration help conserve global forests? What do we learn up there?
Because it's so new, and in fact, we only discovered so much lives in the tops of trees about 15 years after we went to the moon, we're still scrambling to understand the importance of forests, but we have already figured out that it's the interface between air and land, making it really important for climate change. It's what I call the salad bar in the sky, where most of the energy is produced, the fruits and flowers, so tons of things live there, and things go there to eat other things, and energy is produced there. So it's a real hot spot for life on Earth, and that makes it truly important for exploration and really important for the next generations, because we know that a lot of these things that live in the treetops provide medicines, help keep our fresh water supply, are controlling a lot of the productivity, how sunlight is turned into energy. And so it's just truly a really critical piece to keep healthy for life on Earth.
Now, Meg, you've explored forest canopies all over the world. Could you tell us about some of the things that you've seen there, the animals and the ecosystems, things we might never think of?
Well, first of all, there are tons of insects munching leaves in the tops of trees. It's a very noisy place to hang out. It's extraordinary to see millions of insects that have all kinds of colors, shapes, and forms. So if you want to sort of go totally like into outer space in terms of what's different, go to the top of a tree. It's pretty darn cool. I have explored a lot of canopies, mainly in that urgent quest to try to figure out the health of forests when there are not so many human impacts upon them, and obviously that's a race against time. It's full of leaves, billions and billions of green things up there. None of those leaves can run away from their enemies, so therefore treetops have to create chemicals and thorns and fuzzy hairs to protect themselves from enemies. So it's really kind of an amazing battlefield, but with a lot of different rules from what we're used to on the ground.
And what about animals? What animals live in the treetops?
Oh, my gosh. Fantastic sloths and koalas. And, of course, many, many animals use the trees. Even jaguars and other kinds of ground-based animals go up in the trees oftentimes to eat their breakfast or just kind of have a rest away from all the predation on the ground level. So it's full of activity. Birds go there to eat insects, and so do frogs, and even some snakes are canopy dwelling. So it's a pretty wild and woolly place.
Now, you've been to places in the world that nobody else has been because of your job exploring the forest canopies, and I can't imagine what the view must be like from up there, but you must get a little bit of a high. I wonder if you could describe what it feels like to be up that high.
I have a lot of respect for heights. First of all, I'm not really one of these daredevils, but I'm very motivated by the questions that we need to answer about the health of forests, and I'm also motivated because I'm a mom and I really hope to leave the world a better place for my kids. So it's pretty extraordinary. It's breathtakingly beautiful. It's full of life. I almost think maybe being around all those green leaves helps me get great oxygen or something. But it's also a real privilege to be in a place that most people haven't seen and hope that we can conserve it for future generations.
Well, one question is, how do you even get up there? What does it take to get up to the top of the forest canopy?
A lot of perspiration is really what takes. And, you know, I spent half my career inventing new gadgets, which really surprises me so much. The first was making a harness out of seatbelt webbing and learning how to climb from a caving club. And then I went on to build canopy walkways, little bridges in the sky so I could take kids into the treetops. And since then, I've been involved with hot air balloonists and also even people who use construction cranes to set them up in tall trees, and even such crazy things as rigging ladders to the tree trunks of different tall trees. So we're always looking for ways to answer the questions better, and sometimes different tools help a lot. But I really wished I could train a monkey and just stay on the ground and eat my Oreo cookies.
So you are not afraid of heights?
I'm not afraid of heights, but I do have a respect for them in the sense that, like riding a bike or operating any kind of motorized vehicle, you have to have your safety rules set in place.
What are those rules? What do you have to do to make sure it is safe?
Always have a buddy on the ground. Always make sure you double-check your fastening of your different metal hardwares to the ropes. Wear a helmet and make sure you have a bucket or a backpack to hold your things so you don't drop your pencils on your buddy in the ground.
Yeah, they would not appreciate that.
No.
Well, your research has taken you all over, and I wonder if you could tell us about your time in Ethiopia. What were you working on there?
Sure. My latest urgent project really is Ethiopia, because less than 5% of the forests remain in northern Ethiopia, and they are perhaps destined to disappear in the next 10 years based on how we've been measuring their decline with Google Earth images. This is not intentional by the locals, but it's just part of the clearing for the subsistence agriculture. And so I'm working with priests of all the diverse groups in the world. Religion and science are together on this one, and we're hoping to build stone walls around the remaining forests, all of which remain in the churchyards of the Orthodox Christian Church. And it's working. It's cheap, it's simple, and it's really part of the stewardship of their religion. So I'm thrilled to be part of the family of Ethiopian Orthodox priests in order to make this solution.
So you're working with priests in Ethiopia, and you said that the forests are a key part of the stewardship of their religion. Could you talk about that a little bit? How does religion get mixed up with forest ecology in Ethiopia?
Yeah, and you know, when you think about it, for many religions, part of the stewardship is protecting all of God's creatures, and the Ethiopian Orthodox priests take that very seriously. They absolutely insist on having forests surrounding their churches because that gives them the stewardship of all of God's creatures. They don't want to lose these forests, but they don't have access to tools like computers or Google Earth images, and they certainly don't have tape measures to look at their forest decline. So it's been a really wonderful partnership built on the same sense of stewardship, because conservation biologists are also interested in keeping track of global biodiversity. And so right now we have already saved 4 entire forests. We're working our way up to 28 critical forests, which contain essential endangered species and high biodiversity for the country of Ethiopia.
Wow, you saved 4 forests already. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's great.
Where else has your work taken you that's really stuck with you?
I worked in Western Samoa, which was fantastic. We helped a local village build a canopy walkway to charge money for ecotourism, which allowed them to pay back the debt for the construction of their school. So in many cases, I find in some of these quite remote areas, we can combine our research tools with some economic initiative that really inspires forest conservation. And that's become my latest interest, is to look beyond the data collection as a scientist, but try to think of ways that the local communities can benefit from some of my research tools.
Now, In terms of what you've discovered as you explore these forest canopies around the world, what are some of the most remarkable things you think that you have found that the world should know about?
I guess the biggest and first thing that was discovered by me and a couple others in the late 1970s is that, wow, half of the biodiversity on the land part of the planet appears to live in forest canopies. So it's a giant unknown, almost a continent, as E.O. Wilson calls it, to be discovered and explored. And then once we try to home in on those millions of species, we suddenly find a lot of them are important for medicines, for fabrics, for dyes, for obviously spiritual sanctuary, for many, many things, including, of course, fresh water, the whole forest system. So every time we explore something new in a forest canopy, we find it's connected to everything else that relates to human health. And I think that's the real take-home message for my students and for me as I look to pass the torch to the next generation of canopy explorers.
Now, the forests you explore, many of them are endangered. The Amazon, we know, the rainforest is disappearing at an alarming rate. If you could get the world leaders up in the treetops with you, the people you want to really care about the forests, would they be changed if they could go up into the trees with you? What do you think that they would see?
Totally. Seeing, smelling, and listening to it is very life-changing. And if I could do that, it would be a dream come true. Those corporate CEOs and other folks that I've taken to the Amazon, of which there are quite a few, have come back and really changed their behavior. So I do think that that would be a wonderful way to truly change our consumerism, how we do things, and reflect a greener culture. So help me. Maybe we can develop a great communication signal and invite everyone to the Amazon for a weekend.
It sounds wonderful. Meg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and really appreciate it.
That's Meg Lauman. She's Chief of Science and Sustainability at the California Academy of Sciences. She'll be giving a talk at Beloit College tomorrow called It's a Jungle Up There, How Canopy Exploration is Conserving Global Forests. Today marks the first day of what will be a key review of the same-sex marriage question at the federal level.
When the Supreme Court found the Defense of Marriage Act in violation of the Fifth Amendment last June, it set off a wave of challenges to state-specific bans on same-sex marriage.
Those states included largely conservative states like Utah, where a district judge struck down the state's ban, allowing hundreds of couples to marry before the decision was stayed 17 days later, pending a federal review.
That federal review began today, looking specifically at Utah. Moving forward, the panel will also consider a decision in Oklahoma. This is the first time since last June that same-sex marriage is being reviewed at the federal level.
Joining us now to talk about the legal questions at play and the political issues, too, is Kimmy King. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, good to have you back on the show.
Hey, great to be back. How are you?
I'm real good. Well, before we get into the specifics of this review today, bring us back to that federal decision last summer. What changed when the Supreme Court made its decision on the Defense of Marriage Act?
So the reason why we're here today is really about the structure and the relationship between the federal government and the states about who gets to decide what is a marriage and who can tell the states that they have to accept a marriage, or can the states make these determinations on their own. So what's at issue in Windsor, U.S. versus Windsor, involved the Defense of Marriage Act, which in essence the Supreme Court came down in a very controversial decision, because this is a very difficult issue. What the court, in essence, came in and said is that federal government, you cannot say to same-sex couples who are lawfully married that they are not married and not entitled to federal benefits, because marriage is not a federal decision to make. So denying them benefits is a problem. So both parties could walk into court today and look back at Windsor and say, hey, Windsor is a victory for us, because Windsor says, in essence, that gay marriage can be acknowledged by the federal government, but those who are opposed to gay marriage could go into court and say, hey, they've said it's to be left up to the states, and so Utah has decided they don't want to have it. So that's why there is this gray area that we are resolving, and everyone's watching the Utah case because there are four other courts of appeals decisions across the country that, well, four other courts of appeals cases that are pending that are potentially winding their way to the Supreme Court.
And that decision was just kind of the starter gun for a whole bunch of challenges like this, it seems like.
That's correct. And, you know, part of this issue in trying to explain it to people, it's about our laboratories of democracy and the federalism system that we have, which gives states the authority to be able to make certain kinds of decisions within certain parameters. There are limitations placed on the states. For example, one of the judges today in the Utah same-sex marriage raised the issue of how is this different from denying interracial marriage, which until 1968 could be prohibited by the states until the Supreme Court said you can't do that.
So this is the federal government in the form of the courts of
Correct.
Appeals right
Correct.
Now, weighing a decision, is there a state's right to limit who can be married? And is that right greater than an individual that says, wait a minute, I have a right to marry whoever I want? So it's a state right versus an individual right that the federal government's trying to weigh here?
That's correct. And it really is fundamentally about states' rights, whether we're talking about abortion or physician-assisted suicide or the legalization of marijuana. When we talk about the laboratories of democracy and federalism, we're recognizing that that can create a patchwork of laws. So we have, you know, 33 states prohibiting it, 17 states allowing it, and we are going to see much more litigation on this issue, regardless of today's decision.
Well, let's visit Utah a little more closely. What are the arguments the two sides are making here?
Well, in essence, they're taking it back to civil rights. If you're pro-gay marriage, you're going to take it back to civil rights days. And you're going to make the argument that, look, just because the state of Utah, through a referendum, overwhelmingly, I think the actual number was something like 64 to 36, something like that. What authority does a government have to say that there's a basic fundamental right and to deny that right? Because certainly the southern states in the Confederacy would have loved to have taken a vote on slavery back in the good old days. So in essence, you should think of it that there are minimum guarantees of political rights that you have. Beyond that, the states can give you more rights. What's at issue in Utah is whether or not the right to same-sex marriage is one of those basic fundamental rights that's a minimum right that has to be provided.
And on the other side, people are arguing, no, this isn't one of those basic minimum rights. This isn't a majority depriving a minority of fundamental rights.
Marriage is, and the argument that's made is that marriage is very, very different. One of the arguments made by the anti-gay marriage was this point that, look, you're opening the door for polygamy potentially. Because if you sort of recognize that states can't place limitations on marriage, then aren't you in essence forcing states to have to recognize any kind of marriage?
And another point being brought up on that side is making the case for a social value of promoting a father and a mother raising a kid. I know there's been some parts of that argument have been withdrawn after past cases, but that's still part of the case being made, isn't it?
It's still very much the case. And if you look back at that trial decision that originally came down out of Utah, there's much discussion about the social science evidence about the benefits of same-sex marriage and heterosexual marriage, looking at this issue of what kind of scientific evidence do we have about those marriages. So one thing that's been put forward is that banning the marriage can harm children of same sex, whereas same sex couples are argued, no, what's harming us is the second class citizenship in essence of our relationships, that if we acknowledge same sex marriage, then what will happen is that society will get rid of that stigma.
This is a federal court that represents a wider area than just Utah. Six states, I believe. I'm ignorant on this one. If they rule a certain way on Utah, does that affect all six states the same way?
It's going to be applicable to the Utah case, and then the question can become going forward. It depends. It's going to depend on the nature of the ruling and how far the appeals court goes with it. And in terms of applicability, typically, and there might be some out that they give in the Utah case, carving out some kind of narrow exception, but typically what happens is that becomes a Sixth Circuit law issue that will be applicable there. And what makes it interesting is that if you get another Court of Appeals ruling, which clearly there are cases winding their way forward, in which you have an opposite decision, it really is priming the pump. Really, most scholars look at this and say, depending upon the issue, within 2 to 3 years and maybe even sooner, we're going to be right back in the Supreme Court again.
We're talking to Professor Kimmy King of the University of North Texas about same-sex marriage in the courts.
And we'd like to hear from you. How would you like to see this question decided by the courts? And would you prefer a referendum? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. This is Central Time. We're back with Kimmy King, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas. And we're talking about the federal review of state bans on same-sex marriage that began today.
And we want to hear from you now. Do you think it should be up for individual states to decide the legality of same-sex marriage, or should the federal government intervene on the case that it's an individual right? Wisconsin's being challenged in court for its ban on same-sex marriage. How would you like to see the courts here rule? Would you prefer to see this question decided by voters in a referendum or in the courts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on our Central Time Facebook page. Kimmy, this case today in Utah, I know it can be hard to read tea leaves based on what we know about a court, though. What kind of decisions are people anticipating here, or is this really up in the air?
It really is up in the air, and actually, if you'll read what some of the commentators have written about it, they said you couldn't have chosen a more interesting three-judge panel to have because you have two Republicans and one Democrat, which that isn't always predictive of behavior because certainly a number of Republicans have come out in favor of same-sex marriage. But it is interesting to note that you have a Hispanic, an African-American, and an Anglo male who are deciding these cases, this case, who have no direct ties to Utah. When you come out of a circuit court and go to a circuit court of appeal like they do, you come from typically a state federal court that has been out there. And so it will be very interesting to see how they come down. If you talk about reading tea leaves, people listen very closely to the oral arguments today to try to figure out, and much of the balance seems to indicate it would be a 2-1 decision, which also primes it for the Supreme Court to decide, that would strike down the ban and indeed make it lawful among the 6 states in the 10th Circuit. It's interesting to note that New Mexico has already, their Supreme Court has already legalized gay marriage in that state.
And the same federal appeals court has a case coming up from Oklahoma, right?
Yeah.
How does that differ from the Utah one, if at all?
Well, in all of these cases that you're looking at, and going forward, what you're going to start seeing is a variety of legal arguments that come forward that are going to be put forward. They all vary in terms of the facts and the specifics about why it's being challenged, but they all get at the heart of why can a state make determinations about who can marry and who cannot, and then what are the benefits that might have to follow from that.
And then there are other federal cases coming up in the next few months, I think you mentioned. What other states are we going to be watching next?
Oh, my gosh. You know, honestly, this is happening at lightning speed. I do not think that anybody anticipated that we would be moving this quickly in the face of the Windsor decision. All 8 of the courts, the district courts that have ruled since the Windsor decision, have struck down bans on gay marriage, and they have pointed to Windsor as saying that it is problematic to make determinations about who can marry and who cannot.
Let's bring our callers in now at 800-642-1234. We've got Carol with us in Oak Creek. Carol, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I've been with my partner for 30 years. This is a basic civil right. There's over 1,138 benefits that I cannot partake in. If my partner were to die, it would leave us financially destitute because the government will take 1/3 of our assets in taxes. If people are not in favor of gay marriage, then I have a simple solution. Don't marry someone of the same gender. I don't see how, if I'm allowed to marry, how that would affect a heterosexual marriage. I don't want any special rights. I just want the rights that I deserve to be married. I've been in a long-term relationship. I love my partner dearly. There's many reasons why I want to get married.
Carol, thanks a lot for the call. And that reminds me, Kimmy, there was viewed as a compromised version for a long time, civil unions or something like that, where a state would say, okay, we'll make this thing. You'll get a lot of the rights that would go along with marriage, but it's not marriage. Is that still part of the equation?
Actually, I believe the debate has shifted beyond that. We've moved beyond that because one of the things about civil unions is you start to get at there's a much more symbolic tone to marriage versus civil unions. And it can also mean there are consequences in the tax codes with the benefits that you receive. The benefits that your caller was talking about are exactly right in terms of the number of rights that are denied as a consequence of that, not only at the federal level, which was what Windsor was about, but also at the state level. And it's not just about marriage. It's, you know, one of the things that's interesting is there's a heartbreaking case going on actually in Indiana about a partner that is in the process of dying. And in fact, in Windsor, a death had already occurred. And so it's about being able to visit in the hospital. It's about having your name on the death certificate. It's about custody of the children that may come about as a former heterosexual partner tries to challenge the custody of the children after a partner has died. On down the road, it can be about acknowledging divorces or accepting marriages inside other states, which may prohibit same-sex marriage. I mean, this is far-reaching in terms of the potential legal implications.
And that Indiana case got kind of fast-tracked, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And part of it is because of the fact of the death. The pending death that is about to happen. And so you can have, in those instances, an emergency request where you had a couple who was married in Massachusetts, and they're now trying to overturn Indiana's marriage ban because one of the partners is about to die.
We'll go back to our callers now. Thanks, Carol. We'll go to Aaron now in Green Bay. Aaron, hi. You're on the air.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
I think it's almost silly that this is even a debate in the courts. It's our government's job to provide rights to people, not take them away. I don't understand the arguments for those who aren't in favor of same-sex marriage that it's a threat to them, or I don't understand how two men wanting to get married is any threat on my marriage or my rights at all. I wouldn't want my rights. I'm in a heterosexual marriage. I wouldn't want my rights taken away. I don't understand why the government seems to think that we need to take those rights away from people or not let them have it.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. One concern, Kimmy, is that state governments are concerned that the federal government is taking their rights to legislate away.
Absolutely, and that's always at the core issue of these federal-state debates and the protection of the minimum rights. One of the things that will be very interesting regardless is, and that we've already seen happen, is that states can give you more rights, they just can't give you less. And so I think what you will see happen in the face of a adverse decision, either out of the courts of appeals or ultimately out of the Supreme Court, is that states will only become more aggressive that are pro-gay marriage in providing rights and benefits.
So is it meaningful that the first cases we're seeing since that Supreme Court decision last year are in traditionally red states, more conservative states, including Utah?
It is quite striking. But to be honest with you, going back really beginning in the 50s and moving forward, there became litigation strategies across the country to go and use the courts if there is a feeling that the popular sentiment, the majoritarian sentiment, is against minority rights. And when I say minority, I simply mean people that are not in the majority. It doesn't necessarily mean ethnicity. And another thing that I think is really important to point out is that within the last decade, if you look at the way in which we have changed, even within the last 5 years, we've gone from anywhere between, way back a couple decades, 30% support for gay marriage, to in 2009, upwards of, depending on where you surveyed people and who did the survey and how the questions were asked, you know, 45% to 50% supporting gay marriage. And pretty clearly within the last 2-3 years, you have clear majorities of people who support gay marriage. And most importantly, you see it coming from traditional conservative strongholds. So you have, you can kind of call it the Liz Cheney effect, right? I don't know if you know Liz Cheney, but she's wife of Dick Cheney, who has a lesbian daughter. And she, you know, spoke out in favor of supporting her daughter. You've seen a number of Republicans change their mind about gay marriage, and public opinion has changed because of a personal relationship you have in your family or your extended family or your friends about the issue of gay marriage.
Well, when all the dust settles, we're going to have a bunch of federal court decisions. Probably they're going to end up with the Supreme Court. Do you think the Supreme Court is going to take these and say, okay, we've got to make a decision, set a precedent that's going to be very broad in scope? Or are they going to try to split hairs and deal with a little bit here, a little bit there?
That's anyone's guess. I think that any Supreme Court decision is probably going to be a 5-4 decision, just because based on what you've seen in Windsor. It will depend on how the lower court decisions are related to each other. One of the things that the court looks to do is they want to make sure that there's not this existing controversy out there among the federal circuits where you have a conflict of laws. That can become very problematic for federal judges to interpret. Well, what's the signal? And so to the extent that you get two courts of appeals rulings that are directly at odds with each other, then you're going to start to have problems. The judges use a rule of four for making determinations about whether or not, the justices, I should say, use a rule of four in terms of determining whether or not they're going to hear a case, and it's discretionary in this regard. And so the more liberal justices are probably going to look at these circuit courts of appeals decisions and go, is this the right kind of case for us to say same-sex marriage is, you know, or better to say that the states cannot ban same-sex marriage. Is this the right case for us to hear? And that's what you want to watch for. But once you get a conflict among the circuits, most of the justices are going to say, we've got to resolve this.
Kimmy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You betcha. Keep up the great work. We love public radio.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Kimmy King, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas, talking about a case in Utah, or based on Utah, in a federal appeals court today. Imagine people traveling from miles around and filling up sold-out arenas to watch people walk.
Yep, the sport was called pedestrianism, or competitive walking, and our next guest wrote the book on it. Matthew Algeo joins us today, and his latest book is called Pedestrianism, When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, guys.
Well, how is something as basic as walking, how did it become such a huge spectator sport? Now, granted, this was a while ago, but what was the start there?
Yeah, it was in the 1870s and 1880s, and the short answer is there really wasn't much else for people to do back then for entertainment. We had an entertainment deficit in the United States in the couple decades after the Civil War. And what you had a lot of people moving into the cities, urbanization, mass migration to the cities, working people. And for the first time, people had a little free time on their hands. And in the 1870s, a guy named Edward Weston started walking exhibitions. He would try to walk, say, 100 miles in 24 hours, and people would pay 10 cents a piece to come watch him walk in circles to see if he could do this. And then competitors rose up. There was a guy named Daniel O'Leary from Chicago who said, well, I can walk 100 miles in 23 hours. And then Weston did it in 22. And finally, they decided we need to have a race to decide who is the world champion pedestrian. And the first big race took place in 1875 in Chicago. O'Leary and Weston walked for 6 days there. And it proved so successful that six-day races became all the rage for a brief period of time in the 1870s and 1880s.
And Edward Weston kind of got going on this whole thing on a bet, didn't he?
Yeah, he actually began his walking career with a bet in 1860. He made a bet on the outcome of the presidential election that year. Weston bet that Lincoln would lose. Spoiler alert, Lincoln wins. And so Weston ended up having to pay off the bet. The terms of the bet were that the loser had to walk from Boston to Washington in 10 days to see the inauguration in March of 1861. So Weston walked from Boston to Washington, and this became a real sensation, especially up and down the East Coast. Huge crowds turned out to see him just walk through their town, and a lot of bets were placed on whether or not he would make it on time. He was actually 4 hours late, but he had developed such a reputation, had become so famous from this, that after the Civil War, he was able to do these exhibitions that I talked about.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine today. Millions of people filling arenas like Madison Square Garden just to watch people walk around. By today's standards, it sounds like it could be the most boring sport ever. But I gather you have a lot of esteem for this. What is it that made this sport so exciting for people?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to be careful to judge. You know, we've had a lot of really boring Super Bowls, but people still watch. And why do they watch? Well, they like the commercials and they like the halftime show. And when you went to one of these great walking matches, it wasn't just to watch the people walk. There would be brass bands playing songs. There were, vendors selling everything from pickled eggs to roasted chestnuts. You had celebrities would show up. Chester Arthur, who was a future president, was a big fan. Tom Thumb from Barnum's act was a big fan. And so you kind of went for the spectacle as much as to watch these guys just walking in circles.
Well, in your book, you say these walking competitions, they could last for days. You talked about the six-day competitive walk.
Right.
How did the athletes continue to keep going for so long? I mean, how did they eat, sleep, go to the bathroom?
It was really an exercise in sleep deprivation more than anything. These guys would usually sleep about 3 hours a day, and they did it in increments. So they would sleep for 15 to 30 minutes several times during the day.
So that was allowed.
Yes. What they would do is they would have cots, even small tents, inside the track. And it was there they could retreat, they could rest. That's where they went to the bathroom. There was a chamber pot in there. And they would take their meals usually while they walked. They could eat and drink while they walked. And so they were in motion about 21 out of 24 hours a day. And so usually when you went, even if you went in the middle of the night, and that was one of the attractions of the sport, is that it was continuous, 24/7 for 6 days. And so a guy who worked a late shift, an overnight shift, shift workers could get off work at 7 a.m. or 11 p.m. and they could go to the great walking match and see it. And so there was always something to see.
Now, were these pro walkers, were they what you would call real athletes by today's standards?
It's funny. I interviewed several endurance athletes for the book, and they were all familiar with this. Yes, I would say that what they accomplished, especially considering the equipment they had, I mean, they didn't have good shoes, for one thing. They usually just did this in boots. You hear a lot of stories about their toenails falling off after a couple days. It was really a very rigorous athletic exercise. And these guys, in the end, were going as much as 600 miles over the course of 6 days. And even today, people who have tried to replicate their feat, it's generally really only endurance athletes, triathletes, those kinds of athletes that can replicate what these guys did, 140 years ago.
Now, we're calling them guys, but were there women involved?
Were there women.
Immigrants, that kind of thing?
Yeah, there were six-day races featuring women, and there were several very famous women pedestrians I talk about in the book. And the problem, though, was that the conventions of the time, of the Gilded Age, the Victorian conventions, required women to wear full-length gowns or dresses when they walked. they couldn't show their shapely calves. So it was a little more cumbersome for the women. It really wasn't fair. It was not an equal playing field for the women. But the women's races were quite popular in their own right.
You talk about the sport being involved in some seedy activities, which have a lot of modern-day resonance, things like doping and gambling. Can you talk about some of the seedy scene that surrounded this pedestrianism?
We had our first great doping scandal in pedestrianism in 1876 when Edward Weston, who we talked about earlier, was found to be chewing coca leaves while he walked, which apparently was he felt it was a stimulant that might give him some advantage. There really wasn't any rule against it, but it was definitely considered unsportsmanlike. And even more serious were the gambling problems. As it became more popular with the public, pedestrianism also became popular with gamblers, and gamblers colluded with some of the competitors to fix races. And this really diminished public interest in the sport.
Can you share a story or two about one of the most famous matchups from this era?
Edward Weston and Daniel O'Leary, I guess, were the two most famous pedestrians of the time. And some of their walks took place at the first Madison Square Garden in New York. It was built by P.T. Barnum in 1874. And these races were six-day races. And there were other competitors as well, but O'Leary and Weston were the two main attractions. And there would be crowds of 10,000 a night. And that was the capacity of the arena at the time, 10,000 a night. And on one occasion, there were so many people that wanted to get in that they started to riot outside the arena. It was said to be the biggest riots, the biggest riot in New York City since the Civil War draft riots about 10 years before. Wow. And so it gives some idea of the enthusiasm that these two competitors especially generated.
If you could go back in time, would you want to see one of these matches yourself? And would you like to see it resurrected today?
I think it would be cool if it was resurrected today, mostly because it would give my book a little push. But I do. I would love to go back. It's a shame. We don't really have any photographs. It's sort of the tail end of the era where newspapers and magazines all depended on artists to sketch drawings of this. So we really don't have a photograph of what it really looked like. And it was a very, like I said before, it was a spectacle. It was a colorful event. And it would be really neat to see it, to go back in time, obviously, to see it, but also to see it rejuvenated.
So what happened? What pushed competitive walking, pedestrianism, out of favor?
A couple of things, the scandals we talked about, but more importantly, in 1885, there was an Englishman named John Starley, and he invented the modern bicycle. Before that, the bicycles were those big, the ginormous front wheel and the little back wheel, penny farthings they were called. But John Starley invented the safety bicycle. It's the bicycle we know today with the two same size wheels and the drive, drive chain. And these were much more fun to watch race for 6 days than watching people walk in circles. And really, it was just a matter of years before the great pedestrian, the great walking matches were replaced by the great six-day bicycle matches. Also, baseball became very popular by around 1890 and became a very popular spectator sport. And that also helped to kill pedestrianism.
But we do have what's now known as the Olympic sport of race walking. Did pedestrianism spawn that?
Yeah, it did. And competitive race walking was in the first Olympics. It may be the only track and field event that's been in every single Olympics. And so we do have, in a way, we have the logical heirs to O'Leary and Weston. Weston are the modern race walkers. They look funny swiggling their hips, going heel toe, heel toe. But that's a little bit what it looked like. These guys were akin, especially reading about how they walked. It sounds like they walked a lot like modern race walkers do.
Well, Matthew, thank you. Shined a light on something we don't know a lot about today.
Can I get a plug in real quick? I'll be at Boswell Books in Milwaukee at 7 tonight.
Absolutely. Boswell Books tonight at 7 o'clock. Matthew, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Matthew Algio, the author of Pedestrianism, When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport.
Coming up next, should Wisconsin raise the minimum wage? The Wisconsin survey asked that question. We'll ask what you think coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.